So thank you very much for having me here to talk about modeling light curves. We heard a lot already about supernovae light curves, and I'm going to be talking about the low mass counterpart. Hopefully, I know I've learned a lot from hearing you guys speak about supernovae. Hopefully, you'll be able to take something away from what we talk about here today. So before I run out of time, I want to acknowledge a lot of people. I won't list everyone by name, but especially John Wenskovich, who I'll show you his Fluxy code for visualizing these mergers and the spectral flux density. Jason Ferguson for providing custom-made opacity tables, both Planck and Rosslyn, down to very low densities and temperatures. Evgeny Gaborov for our gravity routine. And I've collaborated with a bunch of people on mostly these two systems, V838MON and V1309SCO. I'll talk about each of these. I'll have to acknowledge NSF, and I love the fact that 1309 is in the NSF grant number itself. So this was meant to be that I would analyze V1309SCO. So what is this system? This is the eye magnitude light curve. And it was being observed, but they didn't, after the fact, they went back and said, wait, I think we have all these Ogle data where we have the light curve versus time. And Thailenda folded these data from early times and realized that it was a contact binary that caused this. And so here's the merger in 2008 up to a peak. And the peak actually is higher than what's shown on this graph here. And so this really nailed home the case that these what are called intermediate luminosity red transients or intermediate luminosity optical transients or luminous red novae, it goes by a few names, that they were at least some subpopulation of them caused by contact binary mergers. So if we zoom in on the very peak here, these are the data from two different surveys. I took this from Natasha's paper in 2013 where she collected the data. You can see that there's some sign that there's a plateau. And the idea is that we'd like to be able to try to model these kinds of light curves. There hasn't been a lot of publications on modeling light curves. I mean, the first one was that Ivanova paper where she and Stephen and I were collaborators on that, and Jose Luis Avenando Nandez. That paper establishes that these luminous red novae can be explained by common envelope events. And we did a very simplistic fit to the light curve using the Popov model that you use, the simple analytic model you use for type 2P supernovae. Natasha realized that that could be, in this new regime, applied to these kinds of events. And V1309's light curve could qualitatively be fit by having a superposition of sort of two Popov models corresponding to two outbursts that was in the system. And so there hasn't been a lot of papers that have taken simulation data and then made light curves from those data. I have a paper here with John Wenskovich and all. He's a computer scientist who helped me develop this code Fluxy. In fact, he developed it. And so I'll be talking mostly about that today. It is publicly available, but I'll come back and talk more about that later since this is going to be much of the talk today. And then there's a paper that just came out in the last couple months or so where they generate light curves from grid-based calculations. They use the ENSO code. And here's a result from that particular case where they were looking at a merger of the Passy et al. Simulation from 2012, I believe, or a redone version of that same scenario where you have about a 0.9 solar mass giant and a 0.6 solar mass point mass companion, which merge. And this paper highlights, makes some great strides. It also highlights problems that still need to be overcome in terms of, we talked about the fluff last week, or the hot vacuum gas is what they call it, which in the grid codes help to sort of contain the system. And that makes things very difficult in terms of extracting what the light curve is, because you have to deal with all this low density hot gas on the outside. Their simulations so far don't account for radiative cooling, and they talk about when that may be appropriate and late times that it may not be appropriate, that you'll need to put more physics in there to get the late time light curves. So I do have an approximate scheme in my Star Smasher code for radiative cooling. And so let me just kind of describe quickly how that works. You know, when you have your particle I, it's got a specific internal energy density U associated with it. And that can change for various regions, right? You can just have your gas expanding or contracting, that changes U. You could have shocks going through, that changes U. I'm talking about this last term here now, though. That's the radiative cooling. And we're not doing it properly. We're not doing radiative transport. That would be much too expensive. We're trying to do the simplest thing from local quantities, figure out how quickly should I be able to drain energy due to radiative losses from here. And so this term here is small compared to these other two. I mean, it really is. And if you look at sort of column density visualizations from when you have this last term turned on and off, you'll see little to no difference. But where it does make a big effect is out at the photosphere and beyond, and these really low density outflow regions, which for many years I just didn't care about because I just figured out, you know, quantified how much mass was being lost, but didn't think about its optical properties. But that radiative cooling is very important in the outflow because that's going to affect the photospheric temperature and therefore how bright the object is. It also affects where the photosphere is in terms of how large it is. So I use the same approximation that have been used, I think Stamatelos et al. 10 years ago was the first to do this. And this sort of is, you know, combining two different limiting cases, right? The radiative diffusion case when you're in the optically thick regime, and then when you're in the optically thin limit, you're out near the surface. Out near the surface, it's going to be the Planck opacity, which is relevant. In deep inside of the star in the optically thick limit, there it's going to be the Rosslind opacity that's important. And so you can kind of see here, this sigma is the column density out to the surface. So sigma times kappa is a measure of the optical depth out to the surface. So if that optical depth tau, sigma times kappa is really large, then obviously this term here in the denominator is going to dominate, and you get what reduces down to the diffusion approximation or something close. It's an approximation to the diffusion approximation. And then over here, when this term is small, right, because tau is small, then you get the Planck result.
I don't understand how you calculate a Planck capacity just on density.
Well,
I thought it was more complicated than that.
No, not if you're assuming LTE.
Ah, okay.
Yes. All right.
Okay.
Yes. So it is.
How do you make it simple enough?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We do. Yeah. There are certainly approximations, but yes, we assume LTE. There's a bar over top of these things because these are actually means. Kappa R bar is what's technically the pseudo mean Rosslind mean opacity. And what the pseudo mean is that we're making an estimate on what the average opacity between the current location and the surface is based on some integrals that we do in Lombardi et al. 2015 that follows the kind of work that was done in Stamatelos et al. 2007. So how do we get this column density, right? Well, these different papers might do it different ways. But the way I do it is I use the pressure scale height as a measure of how far it is to the surface. And we did lots of integrals, double integrals over Lane-Emden functions, you know, and basically in the end got a factor of one, which you probably could have guessed to begin with, that if you take the local density and multiply by the pressure scale height, that's an estimate on how much mass is between you and the closest point on the surface, right? The nice thing about the pressure scale height as a gradient is that it points in the direction where pressure changes most rapidly, and so that's likely the direction that light can escape most easily. So that's the scheme that we use, and what's nice about this is that you can calculate it. Yeah, Stephen? Yeah, Chris?
Gas pressure scale height or the radiation pressure scale height? Do you care?
I use gas and radiation pressure. So, yeah. What's convenient about this is that you're already, when you're calculating the hydrodynamic acceleration of a particle, you already are calculating this quantity. So I do not include artificial viscosity because I didn't want there to be, you know, on acceleration, but because I didn't want there to be a velocity field dependence. And I don't include gravitation, but everything else that goes into the pressure I used in the pressure scale height.
So the pressure scale, I think you've said this, but I'm going to ask the question again and see if I have it wrong. So you have, for each particle, you can calculate the pressure gradient, you can then get the pressure scale height,
right.
And then you have the pressure, okay. And then so for each particle, you can do this du dt.
Right, exactly, yes. That's right. So now we have a way of draining energies. We also want to make a way of visualizing what the system would look like. And the nice thing about simulations is you can pretend that you're up nice and close and actually resolve the system. And that's going to allow us to understand features in the light curve. When there's little bumps and wiggles on the light curve, we can look at the resolved system and say, oh, I understand why it got brighter or dimmer in these bands and so on. So I'll outline the approach that we present. Basically, you've got your system. And you can view it from many different angles. There was just this paper that came out within the last month or two by a Noam Soker, who was second author and a collaborator, about how there might be these type 2 intermediate luminosity optical transients, meaning in small number of cases, the gas is outflowing in a disk, and that blocks you from seeing the binary right away. And so that affects what the light curve looks like. And so the point I'm trying to make is the viewing angle here is very important, right? And so we have it so you can set up and rotate the coordinate system so you can look at any angle, and we make the new XY plane be the plane of the sky. And then we partition our system onto a 2D rectangular grid. And then in each grid cell, I'll talk about this in a moment in more detail, we're going to integrate in through the center of the grid cell to get optical depth and flux and spectral flux density as a function of Z, the coordinate into the sky. So just to visualize this, John Wenskovich made this and several other slides that I would show you. You've got a bunch of SPH particles. Each of those SPH particles has a smoothing length associated with it, a smoothing kernel that surrounds it. So its mass is spread out over that sphere. And so what we want to do is we take the system that we're looking at. This has already been projected onto the sky now, and we put down a rectangular grid. And we're going to be integrating into the center of each of these grid cells. And specifically, what we're going to be integrating is for the optical depth tau, the flux f, and the spectral density s sub nu, where nu is frequency. And you could pick whatever frequencies you like. We're going to be using the Planck function over here, so we're not doing lines at all. Right, we're just going to be combining together many different Planck functions, but you can pick many different frequencies if you like. And so you might pick, the central frequency nu for the U, the B, the V, the R, the I filter, whatever filters you like. That would be the nus that you use down here. Or if you wanted to make a spectrum, a continuum spectrum of what was being emitted from the system, you could just do a whole bunch of nu values. And build the spectrum up that way. And so this is the usual relationship between optical depth and opacity and distance. The minus sign here is the coordinates choice that we're using. We're starting at large Z and integrating down to smaller Z. So Z is getting smaller in our integral, and tau is getting larger. And so sigma t to the fourth, that's your black body flux that you're used to. And the e to the minus tau, the idea there is, let's take a look at this from the side. I'll point out that we use, before I go to the next slide, I will point out we use some kind of blended opacity. This is, I saw this in some paper on atmospheres. I couldn't find the reference to cite it right here. But this is just sort of an ad hoc way of making use of the Planck opacity at small tau and the Rosslyn opacity at large tau. So here, let's look at this from the side and talk about integrating these equations. So the observer's over here somewhere, and we're integrating into smaller z values into our system. And so the idea is, let's say, you know, you're at this location, you've got a local temperature, you've got a local density, and you've just done the integral, so you know what tau is at that location. And how much of the light emitted from that location would escape, we just use that e to the minus tau factor to weight it.
And quick question. So when you're doing this, you're using the local temperature, but and you have a local temperature from an adiabatic simulation, but then once you're outside of some layer, that would have been affected by the radiation transport. So what do you do about that?
Yeah, nothing. I mean, yeah, you do have to worry that in the outside you might have the radiation field being at a different temperature than the gas. Is that what you're getting at here?
Or that the you know that energy would have been lost to the observer in previous times, and so.
Oh. Well, okay. So I mean, that energy being lost to the observer—that's what that radiative cooling hopefully takes into account from a couple slides back. And I'll be the first to admit that this is not entirely self-consistent because we're using, you know, here we're calculating tau a different way than what we calculated tau than we did the cooling. So there's no guarantee that these things are going to match up and be perfectly consistent.
Okay, but yeah, that answers the question.
Right. So, and likewise, you know, we're adding up many different Planck black body curves with a weighting factor of e to the minus tau. So you, in the end, don't get a black body curve coming out from any grid cell. It's a superposition of many. So Fluxy is this publicly available software, and it was designed then for looking at spectral densities and effective temperatures. If you know the flux coming out of a grid cell, you can calculate an effective temperature of that grid cell. And so here you can imagine, you know, looking at the spectral densities in the I filter, the R filter, the V filter, and then you could decide how you're going to, you know, your color bar for each of those, and then superpose those to make sort of an image that you could try to make realistically colored. I'll show you different things on how we color. I haven't yet talked about light curves, though. And yeah, go ahead.
Just L2 outflow. So is that a?
Oh yeah, the binary is here at the very center. Yes, and it hasn't merged yet. That's why you can see down through it. You can see the primary right there, and there is that's L2 outflow. And this is I'll show you more about this simulation. It's 320,000 particles, and yeah, you can definitely see individual SPH particles in it. Which I think is some of this blob, but some of the clumpiness may actually be real. And you know, depending on where you put your lower limit on your color bar, you can see more or less of those effects in the outer layers. Right. So, all right, what about light curves? We got all these spectral flux densities. Those are fluxes per frequency per stir radian coming out of these grid cells. And we want to know, though, what an observer far away would see, right? And so, of course, the light falls off like 1 over r squared, where r naught's here the distance to the observer. So this is basically, this summation is what we do in our code, but it's representing an integral over the system to figure out how much light reaches the observer far away. If you want to calculate an absolute magnitude, you put the r naught to 10 parsecs. If you're working on apparent magnitudes, you put your R0 to whatever value you think is the distance to the system you're viewing. And that gives you then the flux density locally. And there are constants there that are appropriate for any particular filter that you can look up in tables that give you what the zero magnitude would be. You can put in models where you account for extinction, interstellar extinction on the way, and so in the end you can get out what the apparent magnitude is at any frequency or filter that you like. So here's an example case that we'll show you. Stepien, I think, came up with an idea that perhaps the V1309 SCO was a merger of stars of approximately these masses, and so we'll use that as an example case. This is a 320,000 particle simulation. It's an equation of state tabulated from MESA. Jason Ferguson's Rosslyn and Planck opacities. He's given me different tables, some that have no grains and no molecules, some that have grains and molecules, some that have molecules but not grains, right? So all these different combinations, because it's a very complicated problem. In the real physical system, molecules and grains are going to be forming as the system evolves. And so there's no one table that's going to work for you. But in the simulation itself, I happen to be using, in this case, opacity tables that had molecules in them but didn't have grains, dust grains in them.
How are these tables different from the ones, the Ferguson tables that were used in Mesa for low temperatures? Are those just Roswell tables, or they were including some of these issues?
Yeah, I mean, I really pushed him to go down to as low a temperature as he could possibly go.
You managed to get him to go to a lower temperature.
He's also very nice. He let me give him whatever composition I wanted. So I went and I dug up all the V838 mon observations and figured out for each element how much people thought was in there. So there's a little bit of composition effect.
Great.
Yes.
Is there any reason why we shouldn't try to get those back into Mesa?
No. I mean, I'm sure he'd be happy. And I have the data available if. So, you know, there's things that I can do better than this, but in that radiative cooling scheme, I didn't point it out, but there was a T-naught background temperature term in there that needs to get set, and that, different ways you can think about how to set that, but like if you have a bunch of stars in the vicinity, they'll have radiation that's coming in that will prevent the gas from getting too cool, or even the star itself, the merger product itself, can prevent the light coming out, can prevent the gas from getting too cool. Pechka, in a recent paper, I think, does better than what we're doing here in that he's got a position-dependent, basically it turns out to be a position-dependent background temperature chosen in a well-defined way. He actually has a heating term from the inner star in addition to a cooling term.
When you say background temperature, do you mean it's a floor or just an initial?
It's not a strict floor in the sense like it drops down, and then stops at that value, but rather it's something that you asymptotically approach as it cools, right? And so the temperature to the fourth is measured relative to background temperature to the fourth in the equation that gives you the rate of change of U. So you would asymptotically approach the background temperature. It's not like if you drop below it, it immediately would just cut it, truncate it to that value, though.
Does Stamatellis at all work? That was irradiation of a dusty disk by the central star set the limiting temperature.
Okay, right. And the Stamatellis, they talk about how if you have other stars in the system, you would, for the background temperature, do some kind of summation over the luminosities of those stars over R squared, the distance squared to those stars, to sort of come up with an appropriate T-naught value. But I did follow Stamatellis. I think they chose a fixed constant value of 10K in their particular case. Here in this particular case, I've got 500K.
If you start cool and adiabatically expand, it's not obvious to me that you can't drop below the external temperature.
Yes, that is true. It does, and that's why I hesitated to call it a strict floor, because there are different competing effects in how U changes. And so if it were only the radiative cooling, it would approach asymptotically this background temperature. But if in addition you have expansion, that can actually drive it down below that.
We'll try to heat back up.
Then it will try to heat back up, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this particular case, we're going to look at it from 70 degrees. I'm going to show you a column density movie first, just so that we can contrast to what we see when we look at it with Fluxy. But this is viewed from 70 degrees. It's a column density movie. And, you know, there you go. the axis on the right shows you what the log of the column density is. That's in CGS units. It's impossible to read, but the date is clicking away up here. The time is clicking away. We're going to dozens of days throughout this simulation.
Remind me what a column density will be in this configuration.
So if you take a column going through any point in the system that you like, you take the mass in that column divided by the cross-sectional area.
Is the direction of the column, is it independent of direction of the column? Where does the column go to the origin?
Oh, the columns are many different parallel columns all coming through the system. Another way to think about it is projecting everything onto
the 2D.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
You project everything onto a 2D plane and then it's mass.
That answers my question.
Right. Yeah. So that's the column density movie. Let's go ahead and instead of playing a movie with that Fluxy generated, what I want to do actually is sort of show you how Fluxy works, because the power in it is not making visualizations, but it's in analyzing the data and allowing you to interact with the data and so on. And so this is Fluxy that we're running right now. And I can go ahead and I can zoom in on my initial conditions over here. And if I want, I can pan around and look at different things. This is running in processing, which runs on top of Java. And so over on the far right, if you look, there's a, I'll use my shadow to point, there's a temperature bar. And as I pan around on this, I see that I have everywhere a temperature of 5,069. And this color, these colors were chosen to represent the colors of, you know, black body radiation at that particular temperature. And then the brightness is chosen, in this case, by the eye filter, however bright it is in eye. Now, I have to admit, there's a dirty little secret here. We cannot resolve the photosphere at early times. We simply, you know, it's impossible. It's never going to be done at early times in SPH to be able to resolve. And so we, if you do the thing that I described, where you're integrating inward and you figure out what the flux is and you calculate a surface temperature or effective temperature from that, it's much higher than 5,069. And so what I do to sort of correct as best I can for that is to say, if the photosphere is not more than a few smoothing lengths into the system, I do not trust what the temperature value it is, and instead I just give it a constant value, which here was the temperature of my primary from a stellar evolution code. And now what's going to be nice, though, is that at late times when you have outflow, then SPH can resolve where the photosphere is. If there's an optically thick outflow, the photosphere can become many smoothing lengths inside of the gas. And so at that point, we can start to see some of the variations.
I think I why doesn't, you say optically thick outflow, but then you say that the atmosphere is several smoothing lengths. Isn't that reverse?
Well, I don't know if I'm using the terminology right, but when I say optically thick outflow, this is what I'm thinking. I'm thinking of gas that's flowing out, and it's thick enough that the photosphere is embedded within it and moving out with that gas, rather than...
optically thick, when you have many, many optical depths.
Yep. Right. So right now it's right. Yeah.
But the photosphere still will be at optical depth 2/3.
Yeah, I use one, but okay.
Well, I mean, it doesn't really matter.
To say it slightly differently, the SPH cloud is getting optically thin enough that you have.
Okay.
Exactly. That's what they mean. So I think you have optically thin.
Okay. Yeah. So I think.
But how do you overcome? I mean, so Wes was showing this in his calculation. Oftentimes you have a calculation where the optical, you know, I have it optically thin, that's fine, but if in one zone the tau, if I'm calculating down in and the tau is getting bigger and bigger, and if in one zone the tau goes from 0.01 to 1, that's not resolving the...
that's the initial conditions, but the final conditions, that's much smoother. So.
Yeah, that's the point. So right now, I haven't pressed play or anything yet. And so right now at the beginning, it does very quickly. Tau becomes very large very quickly, right, within the first SPH particle on the surface. So we could tell you where the photosphere is, but we can't tell you what the temperature of the photosphere is. And so we do the best we can. So let me go ahead and I try to use...
Yeah, you can find where the photosphere is. It's hard to get the temperature of the photosphere.
Right. So... I used some of this, or I asked John to use some of the same keystrokes that you'd use in Splash. So if anyone has used Splash to analyze SPH simulations before, they know that they can hit N to like advance through one step at a time. And yeah, I mean, what's going on here? It looks a little bad because these are big particles, but you're starting to lose mass out the L2 point. Right, and so you're seeing individual particles being shed out that L2 point there, and we can go ahead and we can zoom out a little bit, And it's just starting to make that excretion disk. And you can still kind of see the binary at the center swarming around. Now, I did these data files last year. When you see this blue like that, that's not a mistake of Fluxy. Fluxy just plots for you whatever you hand it. But that's a mistake in my post-processing where I trusted those grid cells' temperatures. Since then, I've changed it, so you know it's got to be in a little deeper before I trust the temperature. But that's the kind of thing that you'd see there. So you can see this disk is starting to be build up. And as I mouse over different things, if you look at the temperature bar over on the right, you can get an idea of what the outflow temperatures are like. As I kind of follow the outflow, you see we get to lower and lower temperatures as that gas has had more opportunity to cool.
You are hitting the maximum value somewhere in the outflow, I noticed.
Maximum value of the brightness?
Yep.
Now, if I want to, I can change that kind of thing. So if I, what is it? I think it's...
I'm at the stellar initial temperature. So you're hitting the Mesa model initial temperature of not just on the stellar disk, but also in the outflow.
In the outflow, it went up to 10,000?
It wasn't 10,000, right? It was 5,000.
You're saying that the red brightness filter hit the max?
No, the color temperature.
The color temperature hit the max? Yeah, I mean, I think that if it hits the max, it's got to be blue. So there it hits the max. And if I like, I can change the color bounds. I can come over here and I could change, you know, what my upper bound is for the temperature and so on. So I could see. But unless it's blue, it's not going to be hitting that maximum. It maybe there was a delay. Sometimes there's a delay, like if my mouse is here and I quickly move it over to the other location, it may not update right away. So we can kind of play through this if we like and animate. And if you look carefully, you can kind of see there's like a hose of material that's just spewing out gas through the L2 point into the disk. And by the way, this is the light curve window. And we're looking here at three different filters, the V, the R, and the I filter. So this is V, this is R, this is I, as calculated. Now, at this moment, we're starting to get very close to the peak brightness, and we can no longer see into the center of the system, right? We've just very recently had the two stars merge, and there's been an outflow. And now we'll go ahead and why don't we back it up? It's usually on the order of like 5% or something like that. Yeah. So let's just go ahead and play it. We'll watch it go through. So you get the merger right in here. And then you get an outflow, which is constrained by some of the material in the excretion disk. So you end up getting this interesting, and almost to me looks like a bagel sandwich shape, where you've got a kind of material coming out the top and coming out the bottom. And this is a little different than what in these high mass simulation that I showed in a talk last week, where it seemed like the gas continued to come out in the excretion in the plane. One comment on that is Natasha saying in these low mass cases, recombination energy may play an important role in ejecting the gas. The other thing is, this is what the system looks like. And just because there's not a lot of mass there doesn't mean there's not a lot of light there. And, you know, this was the kind of simulation that I wanted to make for years and years, because you make those column density movies, but it doesn't really show you what it looks like, right? And so, yeah, there's issues with this, lots of approximations. You can see individual particles and so on, but this is, you know, the best simulation that I've made in terms of understanding what these things would actually look like. And now you can see in these later stages, we're on the decline. What's going on is the gas is still outflowing. It's becoming less dense, more diffuse, more transparent. And in that dissipation, then you're going to start to see down towards the central merger product more. But you don't have this large area of the photo, quote unquote, sphere, and so it's going to be getting dimmer and dimmer with time.
What are the two peaks corresponding to? The first one is the merger.
Oops. Didn't want to do that. The first one is the merger, And I think...
And then it drops and then it starts going back up again.
Yeah. And that's exactly what Flux is kind of built for. I think this is kind of like a plateau where there's competing effects here. The gas is cooling because it's expanding, but the area of emission is getting larger. And so you get a rough balance for a while before it starts to drop off. As for why it goes down and then up and then down, that's a little bit harder for me to on the spot try to explain. But you can do things like that. Like, let's say you wanted to know that question. You know, you can click on the light curve over here in Fluxy and it'll bring you to that stage. You know, we could click on the light curve here. We could see what's going on at that moment. We could click on the light curve there. So it looks like here, you know, it's still small enough that despite there being some hot regions, it started to be at a minimum, but then it got bigger, and even though it was cooler, that happened to be a little brighter overall. Now, over here, I've been using coloring scheme that was based on the temperature, the effective temperature, but you can, you can turn on different filters as well. I could show you one filter at a time, for example. There's just the blue data, and this projection, it's kind of hard to see right there. But here's like the R data, and we could look at the R filter individually. Here's the, that's R again. Here's the I data, for example. And in the end, though, you know, you can choose up to three of these filters and superpose them and so on. The bars over on the right, then, are giving you the flux densities in each of those filters, right? The log values of those flux densities. So
linear scale?
The flux densities are actually shown on a log scale here. So minus 6 means 10 to the minus 6, and it's in CGS units.
So the...
Oh, it's a linear scale on the color bar.
Yeah, but I meant the when I look at these light curves.
Yeah.
So the differences between them is factors of what?
Oh, these are all in magnitudes here.
Okay.
You can turn, like right now I have it with extinction. I can turn off extinction if I like. I can also, you know, display absolute magnitudes if I like. But this is going from, you know, 17 up to 9 in this particular case magnitude.
So the
separation between them is a little less than a magnitude in this case. And if you look at the real systems, like V1309 SCO, at late times, these curves get farther apart from one another because the gas is cooling. My guess is, in this simulation, doing that as quickly as what happens in real life. So here's... a pre-cooked visualization that I made of that same scenario. So you can watch the light curve develop as it goes through the merger process there. Makes the excretion disk. You have the merger. You lose gas in all directions, but it's constrained by the gas in the disk. And then you've kind of have almost a spiral arm of material out, or at least a ring of material out that dissipates.
It is pretty axisymmetric, and it makes me wonder if you were to just work with an axisymmetric version of the same data, would you get a more accurate,
more resolved? Yeah.
Well, the problem is it's being fed by the spiral of the L2 point, so you have to just pick some late time where you kind of smooth it out in azimuth and then study it.
Now, right. Now, what Pechka did to get much better resolution in terms of the disk is he didn't resolve the binaries themselves. He just put many particles coming out the L2 point and followed them with SPH. But then he can't watch the merger. And so, you know, one could imagine some kind of hybrid scheme where you do better. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it does look very axisymmetric.
Do you know how many particles are in your outflow?
Not off the top of my head, though, but no. But, you know, it's probably many. I hope it's tens of thousands.
Oh, so the 320 also includes the stars.
Yeah, the 320 also includes the stars.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's why at the beginning you see these big blobby things falling out L2, because those are like individual SPH particles, the first ones that happen to leave L2.
And so that would imply that you're dredging up some material that start initially quite deep. Like, is the particle...
Oh, I don't use equal mass particles, though.
So I'm saying you're using differentially mass particles.
Yes.
So if one particle goes very big, going to the L2 point, it must have started quite low down. Isn't that right?
No, not necessarily. You lose the ones that are at the surface of your progenitor stars first. And as they move out, you have dynamically adapting smoothing lengths. And so as they move away from their neighbors, they get larger smoothing lengths so that they maintain roughly a constant number of neighbors. So it doesn't mean that they had to have come from deep in the star. So this is an image that I took from Mackenzie Price's senior project, and we'd want to go up to higher resolution than this, but this is to show you a couple things. First of all, that resolution is important, like we've been discussing here. And this only goes up to 96K, number of particles. What I've kind of found through my simulations is that you need about 100K for the early time light curve to be converged. And then for the late time light curve, you need probably around 300,000K particles or more. And those start to be pretty expensive simulations, so I haven't done too many of that. We're always, we can get the peak magnitudes pretty well, and we ways you can play around with changing the masses and the peak magnitudes, you can fit those if you like. We're always too fast on the initial rise, which is consistent with something Natasha said, I think, earlier this week about how SPH will underestimate the time that it takes to merge. And here you can see a dramatic change in the light curve at late time just by going up to 100,000 particles. Oh, I'm sorry. I should have made clear that the black are the actual V1309 SCO data, observed data. I should have said that. That was crucially important. And then the blue is the simulation data.
Great.
Yeah.
So you're getting farther away from the observation by going to higher resolution.
Oh, you think so? Where? I don't care so much about the peak. I care more about the slope. Well, I'll care whatever's better, right? I like that more. But no, the peak you can move up by changing the masses of the stars. And nobody can tell me that these were the correct masses for V1309 SCO. Yeah. But the... Yeah, right. Okay.
So the other way you can change your answer is you have a prescription for your opacities and how you were going to do that emission. And this is the thing that's killing us in supernova. Is exactly, depending on what you use for your prescription, you can get a very different answer. And I am struggling with knowing what is the right prescription. I'm not sure there is I can say you have to do this, this is the right answer. So I can't suggest to you something, I can suggest you things you can try. I'm not sure they will, one is better than the other yet. But this is, I think, the hardest part of actually getting, if you wanted to constrain the masses in the end, getting the constraints on the masses is going to be hard from the light curve simply because...
There's so many variables.
Yeah, you have these opacities, just in the opacity,
you
don't know what you're doing.
Right.
I mean,
so, I'll talk a little bit about some attempts I've made to,
But you can generate spectra, and that gives you a lot of handles on what centering into the opacity.
I mean, you can... you see the and I'll talk about this tomorrow, but if you use kind of the standard opacity things for say type 1As, you get the wrong spectrum. So what they do then is they put a fudge factor to get the right spectrum. It's great. it's based on physics, but it's still it's physics intuitive, but it's still not a consistent thing. So this, people max the spectrum using the second.
This is the modeling is never internally consistent.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry, I wasn't here. What opacities did you use here? Did you use a table from?
Yeah, Jason Ferguson supplied some opacities for us that go down to pretty low, very low densities and temperatures. And in this particular set of simulations, we were using the version where there was no grains and no molecules. Yeah.
Okay. What are the temperatures you go down to?
Well, it depends largely on what you choose for a background temperature, but you know, you go down to that temperature basically. So you know, down to 100 K. Well, what we set as a background, not 2.7 K, but you know, 100 K.
So you can tell your background temperature must be wrong when it gives you a luminosity higher than the thing that's supposed to be keeping the dust warm at that temperature.
Right. You can tell your background temperature, it keeps the dust warmer than what the actual system does.
Whatever the radiation.
So there are some measured dust temperatures for various systems, V1309 SCO and V838MON, and they're on the orders of hundreds of Kelvin.
So actually, I have two questions about this. So one is at early times. So why don't you just match the luminosity of the two stars themselves?
Oh, so I do.
Before the outburst begins, you have two stars.
Yeah, but you see, like this peak right here. I see what you're saying. You might think that this is well before the outburst, right? But it's 50 days before the peak. And if you remember back to V1309 SCO,
it had a rise.
It had a huge rise. So what we're looking at right there is, you know, we're fitting this part right here. But there had been a lot going on in terms of the outflow leading up to that. And so our original luminosities might be able to match better with sort of these magnitudes down here, but we're not getting the right time scale that connects these data down here to these data up there.
And so the second question is about the late times. So do you have to worry about things like fallback accretion onto the remnant object?
Yes,
but not in this case, because here, when whatever you have ejected is very fast ejected.
Yeah, that's right.
In the common envelope case, you might, and it's also arguable, but in this case, no, because all ejected is really well above this envelope.
Because this is just going out the,
it's going out the L2.
It's going out the L2, so it's going above escape velocity.
It goes well above escape velocity, not just because it goes through L2, but because it also, I mean, just going through L2 doesn't say you much, but you also carry all away the angular momentum which it has, and then it makes it about 3 escape velocities.
Yeah.
So even after all the shocks and whatever hydro occurs.
Well, at very late times, when those outer layers dissipate and you can see back down into the merger remnant, you are going to be seeing gas that had gone out but failed to escape and fallen back. And so, I mean, we do need to worry about that, modeling those gas particles if we were going to want to understand the late time behavior of the light curve, I think.
Is the reheating for that, is that included in what you've done?
Yeah, I mean, well, as you know, in principle, it comes back and there would be, as it's shocked, and it would heat it up.
And so the reason why I ask is because I remember Natasha's paper from 2013, that sort of width of the plateau is basically a time in which you're optically thick until it recombines, and then you see down in, that, and that tail is when you would see down into the central object, right?
Yeah.
So that's when you would see what's going on down there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, well, it's not working yet here because there is one piece of physics is still missing. And
what's that?
This is not yet with cooling, right?
Not yet with what?
Radiative cooling.
Oh yeah, this had cooling. Well, it had the cooling in that simple approximation prescription that I mentioned.
Yeah, but in this light curve, which you showed.
This right here?
Yeah.
Yeah, it has cooling.
It already has cooling?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I just want to confirm this. You're cooling, you had a cooling prescription, but then your emission is a different prescription,
yeah.
Right?
Right, yeah, the post-processing.
Did you ever check to see the energy loss?
I mean.
Yeah, Natasha and I have talked about that. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's with sometimes, but it's not exactly the same. So the point that I think is being made is that you could figure out how much energy are you draining from the system during the hydro calculation, and then you can compare that to the energy loss that you would get from the post-processing. And those agree to within an order of magnitude, or if I'm lucky, a factor of two, but they're not the same. And there are certainly, you know, dials you could turn to try to calibrate this to make it better, but I think many of those dials would need to be calibrated on a case-by-case basis.
Is there a systematic direction?
I don't know yet. Yeah.
The artificial viscosity dial would be interesting, because how much energy, I mean, is that impacting your energy distribution?
Right.
As you change the artificial, you've got that other parameter with artificial viscosity, about how strong that artificial viscosity is, and that can change results dramatically.
Okay. So I want to, that's a good point. So I want to also talk about V838 MON. This may very well not be a contact binary merger. It might be a collision between, a direct collision between stars. But this was back, it first outburst on very late December, right, in 2001. And so that's when people started observing it. And so this is already bright here. And then it went through the second outburst, right, about a month later, early February, and it started to dim. Then it went through a third outburst, and depending on what filter you're looking at, you could even say that there's additional peaks in the light curve versus time. So this was a very interesting system. Here we see the light curves extended out to late time. So we've got data on these that we could compare against.
If it was a direct collision between stars, why would there be four or so outbursts?
Because the stars don't have to merge immediately on collision. If it's a grazing collision that was, say, induced by a Kozai mechanism, then you could hit it, they could come away, you could hit it again, it come away, hit it again.
And like an eccentric binary.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I should know this, but did we have constraints on the pre-outburst system?
If I'm trying to remember.
I wouldn't buy that it was eccentric mechanism, because see, I mean, it's when you change the eccentricity through this way, it's a very gradual change, which means that you will have previous mass overflows, and there was nothing, right? I mean, you could just for a sudden get lost.
So, in any case, I think it would need to be a grazing collision, if not an eccentric collision, because you need to have multiple passages to explain the multiple outbursts. But these are HST data that Bond et al. Have gathered. This is not the gas from a collision moving outward. That's the light echo. So that was pre-existing gas that you're watching the light stream through that was made when the stars collided in 2002. And the light echo from geometry allows you to calculate an accurate distance to V838 MON around 6.1 kiloparsecs.
It was a grazing collision. Wouldn't that distribution of stuff around the stars be more elongated or show?
It's not related to the star, of course.
Yeah, this is interstellar medium that was surrounding it. And people have checked to see whether or not maybe from some previous episodes of mass loss that could explain. And there just seems to be too much mass out there to say that it came from that system. So the accepted idea, the consensus idea, is that it's just been there.
This is about a parsec away.
I was going to say how far away is the material?
4 light years.
So, I've been thinking about dust and molecule formation, and I have ideas for how I could do it better than this, but I just wanted something simple that I could turn a dial on to try different levels of dust and molecule formation. And so this is the simple toy model that I have at this point. And so I drew a little picture beforehand over on the blackboard. The idea is that you've got the binary merger or stellar collision in the center of your system, and then you have your outflow. And the radiation is going to prevent, if you're too close into the system, the radiation is going to prevent molecules and dusts from forming. But as the gas expands, it gets cooler and cooler, and then molecules at some point are going to be allowed to form. Even dust grains are going to form. They're not immediately going to be of the equilibrium length that Jason Ferguson assumed when he made the opacity tables for me, right? They've got to take time to grow up to be longer and longer dust grains. And so it's a dynamic, complicated problem. The way I've treated it is in this toy model, I use Ferguson's no molecules, no grains opacity tables inside of a certain radius. right? At some point, I'd like to be able to treat molecules and dust separately, but for now, I'm just lumping them all together into one bag. And then once it hits this dust-forming radius, there you're out far enough that dust is allowed to start to form. And there are papers by Kachanik and Nanny et al. Kachanik sort of talks about what the outflow would be like from these systems. Nanny et al. Talks about the, you know, writes down the differential equations that describe how the dust grains grow with time. And I've tried to take those, and ultimately I'd like to sort of implement, you know, the dust grain formation on a particle by particle basis inside of the SPH calculation itself. But for now, I'm taking that complicated time dependence and I'm trying to map it to just a simple spatial dependence so that if I know where a particle is, you know, I have some idea of how long it took to get there and therefore how much dust had formed by the time that it got there. And so basically, as you move outside the dust formation radius, there's this parameter F, which is going to start at zero and get larger and larger and larger. And I can decide how large it gets, you know, with this F max parameter. If I put F max to 1, then by the time the gas makes it all the way to R equal to infinity, then there would have been opportunity for the dust to fully form, you know, as what was used by Jason Ferguson when he made the opacity tables. If I put F max to 0.5, then even as R goes to infinity, you had an infinite amount of time for the dust to form. Well, it got, it didn't have the appropriate, it wasn't able to, even those scenarios, grow large enough up to those equilibrium sizes. And so I have the opacity, which is no, meaning no molecules, no dust inside a certain radius. This F parameter, if it's 0, then I'll be using no entirely. If it's 1, I would be using yes entirely. And as F goes from 0 to 1, I sort of have a mixture between my no and yes tables. And then this is the spatial dependence that I chose. The functional form for this as a function of radius is based on expressions from Kachanik and Nanny et al.
I'm just confused a little bit about this. There's a typo that you've got, it looks like regular parentheses to the third, and then you got square bracket to the third. Why isn't that just to the ninth?
Yeah. Should have been. I need to look back. I don't think that it's to the ninth. I should look back at what my actual form is. No, but that's embarrassing. Yeah, that's not right. It's embarrassing either because it's wrong or because I never raised it to the ninth. Either way, it's not good. But I'll look in my code and actually tell you what. Yeah, of course. It's a stupid way. Yeah. No, it's not to the ninth, though. I'm like, I'm 95% sure. So I gotta look back at my code, and I'll figure out what it is.
One reason I'm asking is I'm interested in knowing what the...
Yeah. I'll look right after this is over. Thanks for pointing that out.
So what's the... Is there a physical meaning to the dust formation radius, or is it just something convenient? Like, you think it would be temperature or something having to do with nucleation?
Yeah, so inside of that radius, the flux of light from the merger product is too high, and it dissociates molecules or prevents dust from forming.
It's really an equilibrium temperature. Then. It's a time-dependent radius that refers to.
Yeah, that's right. So it's much more complicated than in this toy model. The radius would be definitely time-dependent. But I can imagine going forward with this, you know, because first I wanted to see what's the effect. If there was very little effect from changing, you know, how dust forms, then I don't care. I'm not going to spend years trying to make it better. But there is an effect, maybe not surprisingly, and so that motivates me to try to make it better. And I can imagine, you know, locally determining what the flux of the starlight is in my hydro simulation, and from that, saying whether or not dust can form at that location, et cetera. So there certainly could be ways you could do better, but this is what I have now.
That's a good question, though, because the time dependence of the luminosity, when the central light bulb drops by 5 magnitudes,
right,
that's a lot more important than things expanding a little bit in terms of cooling, getting the material to a cooler temperature,
right,
to form dust. So the dust is going to form basically instantaneously.
Yeah. So here it forms very slowly, but you're saying the luminosity drops quickly, so that
all the dust is going to form all at once because all of a sudden it'll
realize that it's not right. Heated anymore.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Can't you use some formula that depends on the local density and temperature to kind of to do this instead of worrying? Because presumably your temperature is it accounting for the heating radiation or not? I guess not.
No.
Once
he gets
beyond the
atmosphere, yeah, he doesn't have the
heating. There's no heating from the.
That's correct.
From the light. Okay.
Yeah.
So you can't really test the temperatures of the SPH particles once they get outside of the photosphere, once they get beyond object F1. The temperatures are basically, there's no heating from the Earth. There's no.
That's right. So for all the approximations or over approximations, we can still sort of look at the results to see. The axes here are the VA38MON observed data. And it's in the B, the V, the R, and the I filter. So this is B in blue, V in green, R in red, and I is in black here. And the more solid data points are from a simulation. And it doesn't match up well. I have other simulations that do match up better. But I put it here to just kind of keep myself honest. I like to compare, you know, the simulation versus observation because I want to make sure I'm on the right ballpark. And then what I'll do is I'll show you different Fmax. So Fmax equal to zero basically means that no dust or molecules are allowed to form. And then as I turn up to Fmax equal to one, I'm going to be allowing more and more dust and molecules to form. Now, these are all from the same hydrodynamic simulation. And so there's an inconsistency there. In the end, you want to do it so that you're using the same opacities in this hydro as you're doing in the post-processing. But here, I'm just changing the opacity tables in the post-processing only. Same simulation in all cases. You can see that as I turn up the dust, it affects that tail at late times quite dramatically. And so I think, you know, this provides some hope that even though there are a lot of parameters out there and dials to turn and so on, that if you're going to ask questions like what kind of information can you learn from light curves, one of the things that you might be able to learn is from that late time slope of the light curve, how much dust is being formed in the situation. All right. So.
The colors are the spectral band?
Yeah, different filters.
Four band.
EVRI, yeah. I didn't show you the one of them. The
VRI.
I didn't show you, I think, B on the first one.
Okay.
But there's also UData is also available. Are also available. So there are lots of dials to turn. This is an older plot showing bolometric luminosity. Here we're changing resolution. And you can see, like, you know, 80,000, 200,000, 300,000, they all gave pretty similar light curves at early times, but then they do start to deviate at late times, right? And so, you know, the longer you want to go in terms of following the light curve, the more particles you're going to need to use. At this time, I was using just the OPAL opacity tables, and I was, you know, adding some molecular opacities on and some other opacities on. And as you change the opacity tables, it definitely affects the late time behavior. Here's what I was talking about earlier, how if you change the masses of the progenitors, you can move up the overall brightness. In these simulations, I was scaling up the masses of the stars, keeping the mass ratio the same. These were for collision simulations, you know, not contact binary mergers. And you can see as you move up the mass, you get to larger and larger luminosities. And the general form of the light curves, at least at early and moderate times, remains the same. And then here I was varying the impact parameter and therefore the number of passages that the two stars had before they merged with one another. And of course, that's going to have dramatic effects. In this first case here, there was only two passages. With each additional passage that you have, you can get additional wiggles or maxima, as well as more extended sort of plateaus if the maxima run together. So ultimately, it would be nice to do much better on the physics in terms of the dust formation and the molecule formation so that you don't have knobs to turn there, you know, to the extent possible to do the physics properly so that you can...
Let me ask you, in regard to that, so each particle can carry a passive scalar, right?
Yeah.
So could you just have that passive scalar evolve?
Yeah.
And that's what you mean here.
Yeah, I'm not sure what scalar you have in mind, but what I have in mind is like, you know, some measure of how much dust there is. In,
yeah. So you basically just evolve that time dependently
right.
as you evolve the code based on what conditions that particle has. You can include, for example, both of the internal temperature and density evolution of the local field.
Right.
You could also include flux from the star.
Right.
And then you could have some description for
yeah.
how much dust forms as those things vary. It's kind of
right. Yeah, you and I are in the same wavelength there. I'd love, yeah, it sounds like a great project. And so, you know, this is one of our nicer looking simulations in terms of reproducing the V838 mod. I mean, you know, here's UBVRI data. The magenta is U. The other colors are the same as before. And the X's are observed data for V838 mod. The circles, solid circles, are synthetic data. And I mean, you know, this is the these vertical lines, they mark the time of impact. So, you know, the first impact actually occurred over here somewhere. That's January 1st, 2002. And then the second impact, you get a nice rise. It starts to fall down. The third impact occurs deep within the photosphere, so you don't see its effects right away. It takes a while for it to propagate out. And then, so you see a delayed rise from that second impact. And then any additional impacts, they sometimes can be sort of occur pretty quickly after, and it's hard to see their features in the light curve, but they could help to explain why in some of the observed data you have these large plateaus or additional maxima. So
simulated, like, seem to be more parallel to each other.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. So as time goes on, the gap between like U and B, for example, or any two filters you like, in the real data, it grows. And that's not happening as much here. And so, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I'd like to do a lot better. And it's not clear, you know, if I do dust formation better or if I change one of these other you know, things better. I'm not sure what...
Sounds
what
like the effect of a changing color.
Right. Yeah, because as the temperature changes, you would expect the gap between any two filters to change. And as it gets cooler, you would expect, I think, the gap to get bigger in this case here. So it's may not be, yeah, I don't know, may not be cooling right, or it may be that the dust isn't being accounted for properly. So that's just about my last slide. Hopefully there'll be some questions, but I'll leave this one up here as my very last slide.
So that the bacon.
Right? I don't know, this is the bacon right in there. Yeah, I don't know. So that's all I have.
So maybe you have thoughts on this, or maybe other people, but if you doing light curves of these events from scratch, would you choose to use SPH or would you choose to use some other formulation?
Whereas
we're showing grid curves
yeah.
yesterday.
Well, I mean, they both have their advantages and disadvantages. It did seem from the recent paper that the hot vacuum material is going to make it difficult in the grid-based codes to calculate what the photospheric temperature is. And I know that there's a lot of smart people working on that, so I have confidence that they can overcome that problem.
So what they do there is you can say for that material, the opacity is way low, and then it doesn't, you know, alter.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's.
But it does feed back into what it's touching.
So it does have the hydrodynamic effect, but
yeah.
you can actually get it so at least as far as the transport. Is,
right.
It's not a factor.
It's also a very large dynamic range to cover. Start out relatively small, and now you're 1,000 times bigger, sort of radius of that disk, the initial binary or something.
Yeah, so that's a disadvantage of... Yeah, and the reason we'll be hard with SPH is that we have pretty low resolution when you start losing matter at the L2 point. And so I worry very much about that excretion disk being much more bloated than it should be, and not having as resolved of a temperature distribution as you could if you had some adaptive mesh refinement treatment.
Have you considered different mass cells, different mass SPH particles?
Yeah, I mean, we do use different mass SPH particles, and you can turn that knob even more. Like right now, we start in our initial conditions with essentially a constant number density of particles. And so to keep a constant number density, that means that the mass of the particle has to be proportional to the initial density at that location. And so we have particles that cover, you know, five orders of magnitude in mass. The most massive particles are five orders of magnitude more massive than the least massive particles. But you could try to crank that up if you crank, you know, and really put a lot more particles out at the surface. It starts to be, you know, at some point it will become numerically difficult to have really low mass particles being pushed on by high mass particles.
How much does the length vary as you go from the equator to the pole?
Yeah, I didn't show that. And it does. How much? I haven't looked at that in a long time, but it definitely varies. I mean, in measurable ways.
Are these all, what angle are you using?
I was everything I showed you today happened to be 70 degrees. So we're,
degrees off
the, so I equal to zero would mean it's not moving toward or away from you, and I equal 90 is edge on.
Okay.
Yeah.
30 degrees above.
Yeah, 20 degrees above the.
Can you go back and show me how you're doing your light curves? You have some.
This one or the other one?
So I'm. So how are you getting the angular information on the emission?
The angular information. Oh, I would need to run this again. So what would happen is back here at this stage where you choose a viewing angle, right, and you rotate your coordinate system, I would need to start all the way back at this point and choose a different viewing angle down onto my system. And so then you have to go through all the integrations again and so on. And
this includes emission and absorption, right?
I mean, whatever's in
the
whatever is in the opacity table that Jason Ferguson gave me is whatever.
No, what he means on absorption. You don't have an energy source.
No, I don't. Yeah. I only have cooling. Right.
I mean, so like if you have a bright region over here and then some cool gas over here, can it attenuate?
Yeah.
Is there self absorption within the system?
No.
It just assumes that the radiation is lost once you become optical thin.
But
this is it.
Okay. So
there's no internal radiative transfer.
Okay. Because the stuff that Daniel Price's thing is kind of, I remember we were talking about this one day, and it's a lot like solving the formal solution radiative transfer. We used it to generate X-ray light curves where the X-rays are generated, you know, there's a shock and then there's cool gas out there where it's absorbed. And the dipping, you know, it's a self-consistent formal solution of radiative transfer equation. So I'm not sure, I came in late, I'm sorry, but I'm not sure if what you're doing here is better in some respect, but maybe not doesn't.
Yeah, I mean.
So you could be doing, you could just do straight ray traces, right?
That's what I mean.
And that's, and then.
That's essentially.
And you're talking in post-processing only, or are you also thinking?
No, talking about post-processing.
Okay.
Yeah, you would do the, but you could do a ray trace, and then you could get. You get the emission, you get any self-absorption, you get all that.
That's a formal solution of the transfer equation. And like I said, I really astounded about how well that worked for our X-ray.
Right.
Big quantity wind X-rays. You know,
right.
Big shocks and then cool gas around.
Yeah. I'd like to talk with you more about that. Yeah. In the simulation itself, Pejka, and I think in the second paper from last year, did put in an approximation for how the gas would be heated due to the local luminosity distribution. And so that would be a a simple first step that I could take in the hydrocode itself for reabsorbing some energy.
And an advantage of a ray trace is that you then, you know, your Planck versus Wilson thing is less of an issue because you can do lots of energy groups. So you're still doing the Rosalind mean, but as you get more and more energy groups, as they get smaller and smaller, your Rosalind versus Planck opacities aren't as different. You know, as you start to get zoom in on where you capture line features, so you could get a, you know, you could get a, this is kind of the post process thing we do for our light curves. We do this ray trace, and it at least has those advantages.
I'm not quite sure. Can we just, I want to try to understand what's the difference between what you're suggesting and what Jamie's already done. So if we go back to the what you're doing to create the images, that one there,
this looks like
ray tracing to me.
It looks like it's ray tracing to me.
Kappa is a frequency dependent quantity. So what's the...
All right. So this kappa that I use is not a frequency dependent quantity. It is, you know, Rosalind. It's some mixture of Rosalind and Planck means, but I could, in principle, change
that. Switch that. I
could. That's right.
But the one clue is that he's talking about flux here instead of intensity, specific intensity. And specific intensity is a directional quantity. Flux.
Yeah, but we have a direction. It's the direction you're integrating along.
Right.
You just change that df. To the appropriate
DI. Yeah. It looks like it's an emission, and then it's a tau going down in. Is that what it is? Because then you have the emission, and you subtract it by the tau.
This is very close to just doing what you were saying, which is that.
Yeah. I mean, it looks kind of like the
very similar to what we're doing.
So why not just switch?
Yeah, I think it's just doing multi-group with it. And then I don't know why you have, you know, then why, you know, your choice of kappa, unfortunately, I don't dislike it, that choice gives you your answer. What I would use is I'd use kappa Planck for the emission, and then for the tau, I don't know what I would do. But anyhow, that's the problem is I don't know what to do, so yours is as good as any. But I think the error in that is not small.
If you know the local temperature and the source function and the opacity, you just do what you're saying and integrate the.
Yeah. So that's what
we have. It's just very close to what you wrote down.
Yeah.
So you say it's close, but how would I change it?
I mean, it looks like you picked beforehand in the simulation, I'm going to do it only along this ray.
Right.
And then you do it, and it looks like you're doing a ray trace with just gray instead of doing it multi-group.
Right.
So the way that the Christ code works is basically you want to just visualize some simulation. So it just picks rays to the observer along a certain parallel trajectory. It solves the formal solution for your transfer along that ray.
Right.
Given the opacities and emission, which basically, in us, was basically just X-ray emission, and then some bound-free absorption. But in general, if you have some model for what your opacity is, and you assume some simple form of emission, like Planck emission, then it's kind of an LTE, formal solution rate of transfer along that particular ray. It's not a flux, it's an intensity that you see when you look. The intensity is a surface brightness, and so what you can do is then derive the surface brightness as a function of whatever position you look at. And I think you're pretty close to doing that here, but we'd have to talk some more to know whether that's exactly what you're doing.
It sounds like what I'm doing. I didn't have any examples here to show you today, but I certainly could look at this from another direction. And then fluxy, the point I want to make is fluxy is very capable of then just switching around between the different angles. And so you can imagine going from the top to the bottom or orbiting around the system.
So you're using a frequency independent capacity, right? You're fixing the photosphere to be in the same place for all the frequencies?
Yeah.
Okay. That, I mean,
so maybe that.
Things are parallel, right?
Yeah,
right.
That.
One of the things that we. So for our kind of. A lot of the light curve calculations, even in my toy code, I say, okay, I'm going to just do a flux on the diffusion
in the calculation to get roughly the right, then I say I believe my temperatures, which I don't, but let's say I use that to do my temperatures instead of your cooling thing, but it, you know, either one, and then I do a ray trace, and the only thing I do different than what he's doing is, because it's multi-group, then I get different photospheres for the different...
Do you have different opacities for each group?
Yeah, so there's different opacities for each group. And so...
And so you're computing those on the fly?
I grab the tables and I say, okay, in fact, in one case, I just grab the entire table of what the atomic physicists produce, again, using an LTE opacity, but then I use those opacities and I just say, here's what I'm going to get. Now that doesn't help for getting true spectra and supernova because it's not an LTE,
that's okay.
But it gives me a first pass.
Yeah. No, I think that's a great idea, and maybe that will help out a lot. I don't know if I can go and ask Jason Ferguson if he can average. I don't know how that works, if he can give me...
You don't want average. You don't want mean opacities.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want mean opacities.
Right. Right. Well, so I don't have those data available yet, so I either need to go to Ferguson or I need to go to you.
He will do some mean opacity anyway when he... if you go to either the Livermore-Lanham opacity thing, they have... You know, they usually have around 10,000 points of opacity, each of those points has some, they've chosen how to average in that point, but it's averaged at the 10,000.
But couldn't I just average over an I band somehow?
Or you can, then you can decide how do I want to sum, and I'll talk about this tomorrow, but how you want to take those opacities there and, incorporate, get a single I band bin. And so there's lots of ways to do that. And this is the problem with, there's lots of ways to do that, is the error in the opacity, depending on how you choose that, is not, Planck and Rosalind are extremes. Those can be factor of 10. But even in the more subtle differences, you can get factors of 2 difference in the opacity. And this is why it gets hard to be mass ejected from.
Some of the opacities are relatively simple, like if you adopt a dust population, you can get filters and dependent opacities, or if you're dominated by free-free or ground-free.
But then how do you sum those, how do I sum those opacities? You can calculate them. The atomic physicists can calculate it, but then how do I, if I want to say what's the I-band opacity, how do I sum it?
Yeah. So I realize calculating spectra is difficult, but if you compared the outflow velocities in your models to what's observed in spectra, just in general?
Yeah, I know that's a very good idea, and I have done that. And they're on the same order of magnitudes, hundreds of kilometers per second.
Well, you 13 line score, we didn't compare the search points and spectral points, right?
Because comparing what to what? I'm asking about like this SPH model, whether or not the outflow velocities are actually...
Yeah, that's what I...
That's what you mean, okay.
Yes.
Yeah. They are on the right... They're very reasonable. And I mean, I haven't published a paper where I've, specifically pointed this velocity versus that observed velocity.
Can I tell you something about the masses? The velocity is, it tells you something about the mass.
Because larger mass, you expect larger velocity.
In other words, how does the velocity at which the stuff is outflowing from L2 compare to the escape velocity that you expect at that position?
Yeah, I mean... the outflow velocity at L2 is smaller, and then once you have the merger, then you get this material to be accelerated out. And so the speed that it has as it's leaving L2 is not as important as sort of the speed after the merger, right? And the speed I was quoting was the one after the merger.
So the earlier stuff is, of course, harder to observe, but transient studies, transient searches are getting better at catching things early, so you would clearly predict an increase in luminosity, increase in outflow speed, right?
Right, so right, yeah, that's right, you do see that. Yeah, you do see that.
I didn't believe in healthcare anyway,
stay healthy, everybody.
Just stay healthy, don't get sick.
Don't live.
Or move to Canada.
Don't talk animal
I've seen it.
They're gonna build a wall.
Make us pay.
He distributed like the Roger, who's helpful.
Oh yeah, I should.
Sent to Canada, you know.
I should have pointed out. Yeah, Roger Hatful is a student with Natasha's now at Alberta.
It's like putting your savings in different accounts.
I think we might.
Thank you all very much for that feedback. I really appreciate it.